All rise.
Please be seated. The court is ready to hear argument in 060491 NRA Baylor Medical Center in Garland.
Please the court. Mr. Cooper will present argument for the relator. The relator has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Cooper, I'm sure you understand that we've heard a lot of argument already, and so the court is interested in any new arguments that might be made, and the same thing goes to opposing counsel, who I assume has heard the argument this morning. Mr. Cooper.
And again, I was not going to go over the same issues regarding why orders granting a motion for new trial should be reviewable. What I do want to point out a couple of things is, one, we do know the reason in this case why the new trial was granted. And number two, we know that the reason the new trial was granted was an improper and erroneous basis. And that was, there were two jurors who testified by affidavit that they applied the beyond a reasonable doubt burden of proof as opposed to the preponderance of the evidence burden of proof. The affidavits clearly were inadmissible. Even if you counted them, you still had 10 jurors who decided the case on the correct basis. And we know for sure that that is what Judge Cox decided the case on, because he says, that's incorrect, that's not why I gave you a new trial. I gave you a new trial based upon affidavits from the two jurors that said they used the wrong standard of proof. That's it, period. Counsel, in one of the hearings, post-verdict hearings, admitted that that was an improper basis to grant a new trial. So what we have here is we have both sides admitting that the new trial basis...
But we have a lot of procedural rules, and sometimes when people don't follow those procedures, the result may be one that, in fact, the result is unjust in the eyes of the public. Why is it improper to grant one in the interest of justice when, absolutely right, under the rules, this can't be considered, but, you know, we don't want our rules to make us a laughingstock?
Your Honor, in this case, it wasn't granted in the interest of justice. The order that was signed by Judge Cox said he was granting plaintiff's motion for new trial. No mention of interest or justice. And what he said later on September 29th, I believe, of 2005, where he clarified, he said, the reason I signed that order was because the affidavits of those two jurors. That's it. So we know that the reason...
Well, normally in other contexts, when the judge says this is what I'm doing it and then signs an order saying without reasons, we affirm on the basis of any reasons, don't we?
Correct. But in this case, the judge did afford us the specific basis for why he did sign the order. And we have that. I mean, it could not be, I don't think, any more clear than we have in this record where Judge Cox said why he was granting the motion for a new trial. And so what we have here is a new trial granted clearly on an erroneous basis, clearly was an abuse of discretion, and the issue is, you know, can we get it to the Court of Appeals or to this court to review? Now, counsel has made a couple of arguments that aren't present in the Las Colinas case. First, they say that we do have an adequate remedy by way of appeal. And in the brief on the merits, they said that Baylor had not sought certification under 51014D of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, and we could have perhaps gotten up there by appeal that way, and therefore we haven't shown there is no adequate basis for an appeal, or no inadequate remedy by way of an appeal. Well, when we got that, a letter was sent from our office that day, or within days, to counsel saying, here, certify it so we can go up under 5401D. We've not heard anything. We've received no response from them. So I don't believe that their argument that somehow we have an adequate remedy under 51014D holds water when they have refused to sign the agreement that was sent to them shortly after receiving their brief on the merits. I think a big issue in this case, though, is the Porter versus Vick issue. And the question is, if the trial judge realizes that he or she has made a mistake, they still have plenary power, because if the judgment's set aside and a new trial is granted, the plenary power contends on into the future indefinitely. You know, should the trial judge have the ability to correct a mistake that they earlier made? Now, Porter versus Vick was based on Fulton versus Finch, and we think when you go back and dig down into the history, that what was applicable in Fulton versus Finch no longer applies today. Back then, in Fulton versus Finch, which I think was 1961, there were specific deadlines in Rule 329B, and at the time, there were also terms of court. And those deadlines were to require that the trial judge get their rulings before the term of court entered. We don't have ended. We don't have those issues anymore. We have continuous terms under 24012 of the government code.
So when would the trial court's power to reinstate that prior verdict end? Say they get in the middle of a second trial and the trial says, you know, I think I was wrong. Dismiss the jury. I'm reentering that verdict we had 2 years ago. How long are we going to let a trial judge carry this?
Well, I think if there's been a second verdict, then probably it's too late.
No, middle of trial.
Middle of trial, if there's not been a verdict, I would say they can still do it. But we don't even have that here. We have a situation where it's just a few months after the verdict. There has been no trial setting. The trial court clearly is within his plenary power.
I understand that, but so when are we going to draw the line?
Well, I would, you know,
right now it's drawn at 105 days.
Correct, or 75, or depending on how you...
Right now we have a line drawn. So where do you want to move the line to?
I would argue that the line probably should be drawn at the time you commence a second trial.
Why? Why draw it there?
Because before then, why would you want to go through a trial and expend judicial resources and the resources of the parties when the trial judge agrees that the original verdict that was rendered after the first trial should be entered? This court in Moritz versus Priest, we believe, clarified the law with respect to 329B. And if you recall in that case, it was a situation where a plaintiff filed a motion for new trial 35 days after the judgment had been entered. And the question was whether or not the trial judge had the power to rule upon that motion since it was outside the deadlines in 329B. And this court said, yes, so long as the plenary power of the trial judge is in existence, it can act on the motion. It may not preserve the issue for appeal.
Why is it the courts have always looked at this as ungranting the motion for new trial? And it seems to me if the trial judge here had waited 328 days or whatever it was when the judgment was reinstated. I mean, there's no rule that says a judge has to enter a judgment X days after a jury verdict, right?
That's correct.
So a judge could wait 328 days and enter a judgment.
And I've had some that have waited a year to enter a judgment on verdict.
Right. And so there's no problem plenary power doing that. If we think of this second order as just being a second entry of judgment rather than ungranting some motion for new trial, is there any problem with that?
I don't believe there is, because our view is you would set aside the order granting the new trial. You still have the verdict. A new judgment clearly would have to be entered on that judgment, and the time for appeal for the losing party, whichever party it may be, would then begin to run from the entry of the second judgment. I mean, we're sort of, and I was thinking about this as I was preparing yesterday, when we're dealing with motions for new trial, Texas has some sort of bizarre laws. One is the ability to review an erroneous grant of a motion for new trial by appeal is somewhat restricted, but then we're going to even restrict the trial judge's ability to correct his own mistake when it has to do with the granting of a motion for new trial. And I thought of a couple of circumstances. For example, what if you have a situation where the case is tried and the trial judge, and the issue is, did he submit the right charge? And you know, one party asked for a judgment, the other party asked for a new trial, and on the 74th day, the trial judge says, I think I blew it on the charge, I was wrong, and he enters a new trial. On the 75th day, this court comes out, it's a Friday, comes out with their opinions, and there's a case that says, no, actually, Judge, the way you submitted that case was exactly the way it should be. We have a situation then where the judge can't ungrant the new trial. We're going to have to go through a new trial, even though the original trial was submitted with the correct charge, and even though the second trial, we're going to submit it with the same exact charge. It seems like a strange result. Or if you have the situation where the trial judge, for example, it's a hotly contested trial, and there's one party's asking for judgment, the other party's asking for a motion for new trial, and judge does as he or she should. They deliberate, they ponder, and he decides, I'm going to enter the judgment. And on the 75th day, instead of signing the judgment, he signs the order granting the motion for new trial by mistake. Well, under Porter versus Vick, all the parties, even though the judge really intended to sign the judgment, they're going back for a new trial just because he cannot correct the mistake that he made. And I guess the other issue regarding...
Why wouldn't we give the Court of Appeals a first crack at that question, since they didn't have that question before?
Well, of course, you still have the issue, and we're on the right case now, Judge. You still have the issue regarding whether or not we're even entitled to have appellate review of a mandamus. I mean,
why
excuse
can't
me,
we decide the first case first and then give them a crack at that other question?
That was a defensive measure that was raised, and it still would not change, I believe, the view of the Court of Appeals that we could not have appellate review of an order granting a motion for new trial by mandamus, which was their original ruling. The fact that we have another defense thrown onto it, I don't see where that would change that result at all.
But wouldn't that be a jurisdictional question that could affect whether mandamus relief is available in terms of whether a trial court had plenary jurisdiction or not?
I agree, and I would say in this case, in the Baylor case, obviously, we have the issues that are present in Creech as far as the reviewability of an order granting a motion for new trial. And we also have to overcome the Porter versus Vick hurdle as well, and that is to show that, indeed, the trial judge should have the ability to set aside an order granting a motion for new trial so long as the trial judge has plenary power. I mean, I guess one of the other absurdities is the Los Colinas case. The court, I guess, still could ungrant that motion for new trial today. Why? Solely because the reason there was never a judgment entered in that case against in favor of Los Colinas against the plaintiffs. So, but in this case, we can't under Porter versus Vick. And I think that shows that this rule really doesn't have a logical foundation to it, and could result, I think, in absurd results, and I think unduly restricts the trial judges and their power. We say the trial judges ought to have broad discretion, and I agree with that. And I think if they are going to have that broad discretion over their own orders, they ought to have that broad discretion during the entire time period that they have plenary power.
Mr. Cooper, let me ask you, you know, we can point to these two cases perhaps, but how widespread is this problem? I mean, we have a bunch of trial judges out there who are doing this sort of thing that we don't know about. I mean, doesn't seem to me to be a big problem this court needs to perhaps address.
The Porter versus Vick problem?
No, I'm talking about the new trial grant.
The new trial grant. I don't think this is going to be an issue where the floodgates are going to be thrown open and the courts of appeals are going to be inundated by tons and tons of mandamuses along these lines. However...
Yeah, fact of the matter, there are not that many of these cases that come up.
But is that reason, though, to deny constitutional rights to the parties whose cases are affected by these issues?
So even one case would be enough.
I think even one case, if we're talking about denial of parties of constitutional right to a trial by jury, this court ought to afford the measure of protection for those constitutional rights, given the investments that whether it's plaintiff or defendant have in these cases. There should be.
I don't understand completely your argument, your constitutional right. We discussed it a little bit in the last case. You've had your trial. Trial judge, for whatever reason, doesn't agree with you. So you've had your constitutional right to have a jury trial.
So are we saying then, as long as we have a jury in the box and nobody pays attention to what they say, that somehow our constitutional right to trial by jury has been met? I don't think that's what the framers of our Constitution meant. It meant to have a jury actually of their peers decide the case.
And if the judge decides differently, then you have an automatic right to mandamus. I don't think they envision that either.
Well, I think if the judge decides that, for example, he disagrees with them, that essentially you are taking away the right to a trial by jury, because if the...
Well, what happens when the appellate court disagrees and they take away the jury verdict, or this court takes away a jury verdict?
Because it's based upon the fact that there's either factually or legally, for example, insufficient evidence to support that verdict, because we all know that a jury's verdict must be supported by sufficient evidence, or it has to do with some error being made.
Then we get back, I think, to the question that Justice O'Neill asked during the last hearing, that why can't we presume that the judge had a reason based on the order that was presented to him by one side or the other?
And then if we make that presumption, Justice Medina, the question then becomes, did the judge clearly abuse his discretion when he entered that order? Because, again, if we're going to give the judge unfettered discretion, if all a judge has to do when a jury comes back and with a verdict that he disagrees with, even if it's supported by the evidence, to say, I disagree with this verdict, I'm setting aside based on insufficiency of evidence, I believe that is, in effect, a denial of a right to trial by jury, because, you know, your right to trial by jury depends upon the jury agreeing with what the trial judge sees the evidence.
That's a good response, but it seems to have worked for all these years. Why should we change it now?
Well, because the problem is being brought to the court's attention now, and because I think the court should focus on the fact that there are basic constitutional rights that are involved, and I think this court does have an obligation to uphold the Constitution and to see that the parties' basic rights are enforced in the procedures that are followed in the trials in the state of state of Texas.
Further questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the real party in interest.
The court, Mr. Hainer and Mr. Daly will present argument for the real parties in interest. Mr. Hainer will open with the first 15 minutes.
May it please the court. I want to address a question that Justice Medina was just raising. And I think that there's a presumption that I think you go a step further and say, I do believe that they are going to get their day in court. If the trial goes forward, they're still getting another jury trial. So I don't think that there's a denial of their constitutional right to trial. I've never understood that argument for reasons Justice Medina stated. And then I think also when you think about it, they are going to get another trial here. What they're not getting is the benefit of the first judgment. That's not, I don't think, constitutionally guaranteed. So
you wouldn't think your right to a jury trial was being impinged upon if you got the feeling that the judge was not going to render judgment on a verdict and going to try it till he got a defense verdict?
I certainly could see that, sure, but it hadn't happened to me in 16 years of trying lawsuits. But and that goes to another issue. This is not this what they're asking you to do today benefits Baylor Hospital in a very narrow way. The rule that they're complaining of affects plaintiffs just as does defendants and interveners also. So it can be applied to any certain party. There's no compelling public interest to go and do this, and I believe also...
You don't think there's a compelling public interest to be able to tell citizens why something happened to them in the court system?
I think that that's... Certainly there could be a compelling interest for that, but I don't think that this happens very often, Your Honor. I think that
well, but if it happens one time, same question we asked last time, somebody takes away a $10 million verdict from you, that's a tough conversation when you say, I'm sorry, I cannot tell you why that person on the bench took your money away from you. All I can tell you is it happened. And they say, isn't this America? We say, well, yes, but that's the way the cookie crumbles.
And I guess my response to that is I wouldn't like it, but I would say to my clients that I trust the trial court. The trial court, they have the discretion here. This is, you know, this is an elected jurist. that we have to believe is doing this for what he believes is the right reasons.
We review everybody else except in this case. We review everything else and make everybody else tell why they did something except in this. May not like it, may be a reason that is perfectly within the trial court's discretion, and that may be the answer, that the trial court gets sustained on all of these things, but still we make everybody else tell it except for the trial court.
I don't know why it's developed that way. I think it would be a good way. But the fact is that we do give the trial court discretion.
Isn't it true that most good judges around the state are not so short? I mean, they say, counsel, it may not appear in the order, but they'll have a discussion on a motion for new trial. I'm very concerned that I didn't submit it properly, or I think this juror was inattentive, or I think maybe they were exposed to the media and they explain it that way. And the good ones do, and those are the ones generally who are reelected, and those who are not, who don't do that, at least are subject to criticism.
I would agree with that.
On that basis.
I think that's true.
Is that what the judge did in this case?
Well, no, I think the judge in this case made a statement, and I think it's significant to understand when the statement was made. It was made after the new trial had been granted. It was made after his plenary power had expired. And he makes a statement that Mr. Cooper says, he says it's based on the affidavits of the jurors. Well, that may be, that's a stated reason, but the reasoning that Mr. Cooper applies to it is maybe different than the reason I come up with on it. He could be saying, look, I know for a fact, because of these two affidavits, that these jurors did not follow my instructions that I gave them. And based on that reason alone, he could grant a new trial. It doesn't have to rise to jury misconduct. You don't have to go that far. And I don't think you have to do the whole golden archery analysis on it either, because essentially the affidavit just stated we applied the wrong burden of proof. It doesn't talk about the deliberation aspect of it, which is how did we get to the point of that. It point blank states we applied the wrong burden of proof. So I don't think I think you can bypass, or you certainly can argue that you could bypass a whole argument about you can't go into the deliberations of the jury. I don't think it goes into the deliberations of the jury. They're just saying this is the result that we came up with. If that's the case, then they didn't apply the right burden of proof, and they didn't follow the judge's instructions.
Before the motion was granted, did the trial judge have a discussion with counsel about why he was granting the motion or what he thought?
No, he did not. And this is because, interestingly enough, this case, like Mr. Martin's case earlier, we've got a retired judge in this case. Judge Cox left the bench in December of last year. And Judge Thomas, by the way, has heard their arguments on this case. And she, at first, decided to vacate the order of Judge Cox. And then when we went back and had a motion for rehearing, and she understood the law, we pointed out the law to her about the plenary power situation, and she said, you know, you're right. I don't have plenary power to do this.
What's the harm in allowing mandamus relief?
I think you're opening up it's a Pandora's box is what I think it is in a lot of respects. I think when does a judgment become final? If a judge can at any point in time, if he never loses plenary power over a case, then I can see scenarios where you've got, as long as you've got the money to hire a lawyer and raise issues, you can keep petitioning that judge or lobbying that judge. There's a lot of things.
It's pretty straightforward. You have a judgment, and then you have 105 days. But if you have a new trial, you don't have a judgment. And you're right. If you have a new trial, it could last for 100 years. We try not to do that. So what's the plenary power problem in this case?
Well, I guess where I'm coming from on that is that if I follow the logic that you're saying, that once the new trial is granted, there is no more judgment. There's no judgment to apply the plenary the timeline to, correct? But at the same token, then why is what judgment is he coming up here and complaining about then?
They entered a second judgment.
Okay, and I heard when you mentioned that earlier, and I haven't had a chance to think about that through. I really can't on my feet right now.
The whole reason Porter Fick was, if you think of this as undoing the new trial, then we go back to that judgment and your appellate time's run, and of course you can't appeal. But the logical flaw in there is you don't undo orders, you just enter a new one. So you have a judgment, a new trial, and a judgment, and your time runs for the new judgment. There's no plenary power problems, there's no appeal problems, everything works fine. Other than that, there's no plenary power problem in this case, is there?
I guess not, Your Honor. I don't know that I see it exactly that way, but I see your point.
Well, it's not what Porter and Vick says. I don't blame you for seeing it the way we've said it was before.
But on Porter versus Vick, if the second order is void, you would
be allowed mandamus in that situation. That's the one situation where mandamus has been granted is where you've got a void order.
But if they're void, we still are back in the same question of should we or should we not be able to review the original order granting new trial. We're back in the same place as we were on that prior case if we stick with the current law as to the second orders. Is that your view? If the second orders are void,
mm-hmm.
The good order is the one granting new trial that Judge Cox talked about considering the jury affidavits. And that's what we have to look at on mandamus.
That's true.
Is that correct?
I think so.
Would you address counsel's argument about writing you a letter and the adequacy of a remedy by appeal in this case, since it's a contingent remedy? And let's say, for example, we were to remand it so he can write you another letter. And so are we going to see this back on mandamus? Where are we going to see it on appeal? Because you don't offer in your brief saying, look, if he wants an appeal, we'll agree to an appeal. You just say he has an adequate remedy by appeal, yet.
Well, he had the ability to ask for one, and he didn't, I think, until we raised the issue and pointed it out to him.
Right. So if this mandamus were to be dismissed without prejudice or remanded so he could write you a letter, are you telling the court at this point that you're willing to say, all right, let's go up on appeal with it?
I'm not prepared to say that. No, I'm not prepared to say that.
Okay, so he doesn't have a right to appeal. He has only a contingent appeal.
He has a right to ask for it, and right. Yes, that's true. That's true. Again, though, I think that...
Could I ask you about the order, just to be clear about it? It's very short, and it just says the motion is granted. And it doesn't refer to the interest of justice or anything else. So
it does not. And I think what else is important is that our original motion for new trial had expired by operation of law. So when he refers to it as plaintiff's motion, in effect, he's really signing his own motion because if ours expired, I don't think that he could be signing our order. So I think in effect he really was signing his own order because it was, I think, in the 81st day or something like that. When he actually signed it, so ours expired by law, our motion for new trial had.
So you don't, do you think or not, I'm just wondering, he confined himself to the reasons that were raised by the three motions that you filed?
In reaching his conclusions?
Yeah.
I think he told us why he reached the decision he did, based on the juror affidavits. Okay. What we don't know is what he meant by that statement. That's the problem. That statement can be interpreted several different ways. The way I see it is that he could be saying, look, these people didn't apply the right standard of proof. It was a poorly kept secret at the courthouse that the wrong burden of proof was applied. That's why we sent out the affidavits in the first place. In talking to jurors, it became apparent to us that they had applied the wrong burden of proof, and so we sent out affidavits to see if we could get signatures on them, and we only got two back. But there were, in effect, we believe more than that. We know more than that. And that was a poorly kept secret at the courthouse, and I don't know whether Judge Cox knew that or not. But I think that based on those two affidavits alone, he knows he's got enough there to know that the wrong burden of proof was applied in his trial. He didn't follow his instructions. It clearly states in the instructions that if you fail to follow my instructions, it can result in a new trial. And it could be, I think it even says it could be jury misconduct by not following his instructions.
But you're not allowed to. I thought the rule 607 or somewhere around there says you can't do that. You can't inquire into the into whether they applied the correct burden or not.
You mean in the when we talk to the jurors after the
you can't an affidavit like this can't be used for any purpose. And
it's not admissible. I don't believe we submitted the affidavit. We went ahead and submitted the affidavit because at the time Eurista versus Bed Bath & Beyond was controlling, and in that case we wanted to show that the trial was hotly contested. We had two dissenting juror affidavits we wanted to show to prove that there was a highly contested trial. That the court's gone and reversed its holding or changed its holding in Urista. It doesn't help our case anymore, but at the time it did, and that's why we submitted the affidavits. They would not have been admissible, Your Honor.
Upon an inquiry into the validity of a verdict, a juror may not testify as to any matter or statement occurring during the jury's deliberations as to the effect of anything on any juror's mind or emotions or mental processes as influencing any juror's assent to or dissent from the verdict or indictment. So I just don't understand how it was proper to obtain those affidavits anyway, or even having obtained them to use them in a proceeding to attempt to get the trial court to grant a new trial. I just don't understand.
Well, I can't. Maybe we were wrong to send them out. I don't think we were. We didn't inquire. We weren't asking why they applied the wrong standard. We didn't ask them why. We simply asked them, what burden of proof did you apply? And we knew going in that there were several that had applied the wrong burden of proof.
But if he's entitled to consider those, then seems like opposing counsel needs to go out and subpoena all the jurors in so we can get back into the same thing we had before we changed the rule, and that is after every trial you get all the jurors in, examine them and all that. So if he can consider your affidavits, shouldn't opposing counsel be able to do the same thing to counter those affidavits?
I didn't say that they couldn't. I think they should, I guess. I guess they should. I don't know. I think that they certainly didn't object to our affidavits timely when we filed them. I've made the argument in our briefs that they waived that argument. But Moritz allows the judge to consider the affidavits that were filed. Now, whether it was proper for us to go and get the affidavits to begin with, I don't know.
Doesn't allow the judge to consider those affidavits, as I read it, anyway.
Well, I think that the Moritz case... maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I think that he doesn't have to. They aren't admissible, Your Honor, but I think that he can consider anything that comes, basically anything that comes before him, he can consider it in his making his decision. I don't think it's necessarily admissible.
Did the jury charge set out the standard for the
yes.
jurors to apply?
Yes.
What conceivable thing could have led them to think of and apply a different standard?
I have asked that question to myself a lot.
Anybody even mention that wrong standard during trial that you recall?
Did anybody mention the wrong
standard? Wrong standard?
I know that when I talked to the jury on...
By watching too much television, probably.
I don't know, but I've asked myself this question many times because I even went back to make sure. I asked Gil after we found out. I said, didn't I tell him about the burden of proof and all that? And he, yeah, I did. I went over it in Vordire with him, and I went over it again.
Your co-counsel's time.
Okay, I'm going to sit down now and let Mr. Daly speak to you all. Thank you very much for your time.
May it please the court, counsel. Obviously, what happened here, Your Honors, is the jurors applied the wrong standard of proof, and I believe that if a new trial could not be granted under those circumstances, we would be looked upon as a laughingstock, as though jurors could watch CSI and learn that they can apply beyond a reasonable doubt to any court case. Only the Lord knows why they did it in this case. We told them in voir dire opening, and I believe in closing, as opposing counsel did, what the standard of proof was. It was written, of course, in the jury charge, as it should have been. And I believe that trial judges ought to have discretion when they know that jurors have applied the wrong burden of proof, the burden that applies to a criminal case, civil lawsuit.
So those affidavits form kind of the sum total of the basis of your motion for a new trial?
No, Your Honor. We also had another couple of issues with a witness, a key medical witness, Dr. Mata, a treater, including the deposition, video deposition of him being played, which was cumulative after he came live and testified for most of the day, and also with respect to us not being allowed to call him on rebuttal.
But the burden of proof issue was the predominant issue underlying your motion?
That was, and another key issue, Your Honor, had to do with the allowing of evidence of collateral source. specifically insurance benefits, to come into play at trial, which is inadmissible as a matter of law. We didn't know, obviously, why Judge Cox granted the order when he granted it, and I would argue that once plenary power was extinguished and once the order was silent as to his reasons for granting the new trial, then you look at our motion, as you're asking, Your Honor, and see if there's anything that could uphold that. These comments that he made were on September 29th, 3 weeks before we were going to go to trial a second time. Mr. Cooper told you earlier that we weren't set for trial. That wasn't true. We were only 3 weeks away. The issue was that under the Hirsch versus Henley case, as to our first issue in the motion for new trial, the new and independent cause instruction, they had no expert testimony to prove the reason Judge Cox stated on the record he submitted that instruction to the jury. That case dates back to 1981. It's a case that Mr. Cooper was involved in out of the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, and they say specifically that especially in a medical malpractice case, when there's no expert testimony to support a new and independent cause instruction, you're going to get the whole issue of proximate cause befuddled. The jury's going to be befuddled and not understand what to do in that circumstance. That's the way I read the case. I think that's what happened in that case. I think the jurors were confused in our case by this supposed event that happened a month after our claim that Ms. Williams became hypoxic due to Baylor's negligence. She was at a subsequent facility on a respirator a month later, and they're claiming that one document showed that her O2 sats went to a dangerously low level for a brief period of time. Boom, that must have caused her hypoxic brain injury. Therefore, a new and independent cause should be submitted. That was their argument, and Judge Cox stated on the record that's why he submitted it. However, they had no expert come and testify. Of all the retained experts that they had, none came to trial. They relied upon Dr. Mata, the treating pulmonologist, and he never addressed that issue. They only got that in through a medical record that was entered into evidence and then arguing that that's what caused it without any proof from any qualified expert.
Let me ask you a hypothetical, just a hypothetical question. If your motion had been completely, totally based on the affidavits you obtained about the improper burden of proof applied, if those were improperly obtained, if they were then improperly considered and relied upon by the trial court judge in granting that motion, it was the sum total of your motion. The trial court just says, I'm granting your motion. Are you saying that that decision is immune from appellate review, even if it was a demonstrably improper basis for the new trial order?
Your Honor, I believe in our case that is the current state of the law, and it's been that way since at least 1870, that the trial judge does have broad discretion to grant a new trial. If it rises,
if it's demonstrably true that he relied upon an improper...
If it's a clear abuse of discretion, Your Honor, I believe that's subject to appellate review. Answer your question.
Further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I'd like to address three or four things very quickly. First off, the trial judge specifically said he wasn't granting the new trial based upon the new and independent cause instruction.
What if it had been proper? What if the new and independent cause instruction was improper? Hold on.
Sure.
Let me finish my question. It had been a basis of the motion for a new trial, and he said, I'm granting it on ground two, not ground four. Could we not consider that ground in determining whether he properly granted the motion? I mean, we could in summary judgment. You'd admit we could in summary judgment. Why should we not be able to do that here if he grants the entire motion?
Whether or not there is an independent basis for affirming the judgment? Is that what we're talking about?
The new trial motion.
The new trial?
There are five grounds raised for new trial motion. One of them is new and independent cause instruction was wrong. What if it was wrong? But the trial court broadly grants the motion for new trial, new and independent cause instruction having been one of the grounds for it.
Okay.
All right. Why would we reverse that if it was
Thanks. First off, the new and independent cause instruction was supported by the evidence, and it was improper. But second,
the premise of my question was, what if it had been improper?
Okay. Second, I believe that in the review of most cases that I've seen with respect to motions for new trial, the focus is on the basis that the trial court granted it.
And my question is, why should that be? If he grants the whole motion and doesn't say in the order, I grant it as to X.
But if he grants the whole motion, then I think you can consider any. I'm sorry, I misunderstood
That's
the court's question.
That's my
question. If he says plaintiff's motion for new trial is granted.
Which he did in this case.
But then he came back and clarified.
The order says granted.
But then he came back and. Why should it be any different
in summary judgment procedure than it should be here?
Well, I think if he says, I grant the entire motion for new trial, I think the court can look at all the grounds. I think, however, if the court does specify the grounds, like he did in this case.
Orally, not in the order.
Orally, but it's in the record.
Summary judgment. Five grounds for summary judgment.
Correct.
I'm granted on ground A. I mean, I sign an order that says summary judgment granted. I tell you in open court, I'm granted on A. You're telling us that we can't look at B, C, D, E, and F to see if they're proper. I mean, the law is we have to look at those.
On an independent grounds for affirming a judgment, I think that would be true with respect to the summary judgment. I am not sure that that's ever been applied with respect to orders for new trial.
And my question is, why not? Is there a reason why not?
Well, because the judge, I guess, didn't believe that the plaintiffs, that the trial was tainted or affected by the other grounds and did not employ them as an independent basis.
Well, what difference does it make if those other grounds would support it? If we're going to reverse it on independent, new and independent cause, there's error in the record. Presume with me that's the case. Why wouldn't we be able to consider that as a grounds for the new trial motion?
Well, because in a summary judgment, you're looking at legal matters, what's there in the record. Again, as been said earlier, with respect to new trial matters, there may be many issues that are observed by the trial judge.
That wasn't my hypothetical.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm trying to answer your question, Judge. I believe that, again, I've always said the trial judge would have discretion. And the question is, was there an abuse of discretion? And I think if the trial court has exercised his discretion to overrule certain grounds, that could be reviewed, but I think it would have to be reviewed under the same abuse of discretion standard, is what I'm saying. Okay.
It doesn't answer my question,
I think the court could review it, but it would have to review it under the same.
I'm not going to keep doing this, but if the new and independent cause instruction is error as a matter of law,
okay.
All right, it's one of five grounds for the motion for new trial.
I think they could.
The trial court grants the order. Trial court says, I'm not doing it on that ground. I'm doing it on another ground. You're saying our review would be limited to that other ground.
No. I'm saying the court could review the other grounds under the same abuse of discretion standard. And the question was, did the trial court abuse his discretion in denying the grounds? Is all I'm saying. You could do it, but it's under the same abuse of discretion standard. Couple things. One, Moritz versus Priest. If the motion for new trial was overruled by operational law, the trial court couldn't grant it. Not true. Trial court has until 105 days to sign a motion for new trial, even if it's overruled by operational law. Moritz did not involve late filed affidavits of jurors with respect to their mental processes. It had to do with a juror who had been convicted for a hot check and whether or not she was qualified to serve as a juror in that case. And the court said they could consider the late filed affidavits even after the 30 days. In conclusion, both with respect to this case and the Creech case, we believe that the basis that the trial court granted a new trial is, as a matter of law, incorrect and would urge this court to enter mandamus ordering the trial judge to vacate the new trial order and enter judgment upon the verdict.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and that concludes arguments for the morning. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise.
Oyez,
oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, now stands adjourned.